There was a time when children looked forward to getting an orange in their Christmas stockings. One orange, that's all, a treat many enjoyed just once a year. That changed with the rise of the citrus industry. Since the middle of the 20th century, children could expect to start every day with a glass of orange juice. Now the rarity that became a commodity is threatened by a major epidemic. Valerie Alker of member station WGCU has this report.
Jim Snively strolls through a row of orange trees near the town of LaBelle, a citrus industry stronghold in southwest Florida. The sun is shining, the orange-laden trees look lovely, but Snively is worried.
The tree behind you, you see the pink paint that's on that tree, that's not a good thing. That's showing you that tree is infected with greening.
Up and down these rows, inspectors have spray-painted trees with swatches of pink paint, signaling they'll soon be cut down. Snively heads grove operations for Southern Garden Citrus, one of the nation's largest fresh orange juice producers. His company has removed 500,000 trees over the last few years to try to stop the spread of citrus greening. Still, company president Rick Kress says they're not giving up.
When we found out we had the disease in 2005, we made the decision to be as proactive as we could to learn about the disease, deal with the disease, and ultimately find a solution to it.
Florida's citrus industry has experience battling difficult crop diseases. Canker began to plague the state in the mid-1990s. That disease scars the fruit and makes it fall off early. But greening is worse. A tiny flying insect spreads the greening bacteria, which actually kills the tree. Removing infected trees and using insecticide on the bugs haven't slowed greening's march across the state. But researchers are optimistic.
Added a gene to citrus, so this is a genetically modified citrus tree.
Dean Gabriel is a plant pathology professor at the University of Florida and founder of Integrated Plant Genetics. He says genetically modified trees are the only way to save Florida's $9 billion citrus industry. He says it's proven successful elsewhere.
I think it was about 10 years ago when there was a virus that attacked the Hawaiian papaya, was wiping them all out, and because they added a gene to the papaya tree to enable it to resist this disease, then they saved the entire industry.
Researchers have planted about a dozen genetically modified trees in field trials at Southern Gardens. Experts want to know if the trees remain disease-free and that the quality of the fruit they produce will be acceptable to consumers. Ron Hamill heads up the Gulf Citrus Growers Association, whose 100 members are immersed in the greening battle.
Right now, if we could find plant materials or citrus trees that would be resistant to these pests and diseases, I think in the long run, it would pay off for both the industry and consumers because it will enable us to continue to provide good quality orange juice from Florida.
Field tests are expected to take 2 years. If all goes well, growers could begin replacing diseased trees with genetically modified varieties within 6 years. For NPR News, I'm Valerie Alker in Fort Myers, Florida.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Even though Michelle Norris is off today, she didn't want to leave us without something sweet for Christmas.
A sweet that's easy to make and perfect for your holiday table. A gâteau basque. It's a simple cake with filling, kind of like a tart. It's a specialty from the Pays Basque region of France, and it comes to us by way of Dory Greenspan.
I'm going to let it go for a minute and then grab an egg.
She's the author of Baking, From My Home to Yours. She came to my home recently for what's become our annual holiday baking soiree.
Get down there.
And if you know anything about Dory Greenspan, you know she's a Francophile. Over the years, she's taught us to make a tarte tatin, where we learn to caramelize apples and, for the coup de grace, flip a cast iron skillet. And we created hors d'oeuvres with puff pastry using a classic French dough called a pâte à choux, a cabbage dough. Today, it's all about gâteau basque.
It's called a cake, and normally, when you think of cake, you think of batter. But this isn't a batter. This is really a dough.
A dense dough that even taxes our mighty mixer. Dory says the cake will be dry but delicious.
The cake gives you a clue of what's inside. If the cake is filled with pastry cream, then it has a kind of crosshatch pattern on the top. If it's filled with cherry jam, it has a Basque cross on it. And I never make enough extra cake dough to make that little cross, but I love filling the cake with jam. So mine is like a hybrid. I always fill it with jam, but do the crosshatch pattern that would be for pastry cream.
Okay, no, if you were actually in the region, this would be very confusing to them.
Because it would be so confusing. And they'd probably come back and complain, I didn't get what I wanted. You could pat it out like that.
The dough for gâteau basque is a basic butter, sugar, eggs, flour combination with vanilla and baking powder too, and it's not to be overly mixed. Dory pats the dough into two discs and then rolls out two circles slightly bigger than 8 inches in diameter. That's the top and the bottom of the gâteau basque, but it's got to be refrigerated before we can go on.
Okay.
Now, while we wait, Dory tells me about her recent visit to Basque Country. It's an area about the size of Rhode Island, straddling the border between Spain and France, with a distinct culture and distinct cuisine. Dory and her husband were on the French side, enjoying the stuffed peppers and, of course, this cake. She says she pretty much ate gâteau basque morning, noon, and night at the hotel, in the cafe, at the markets, and then serendipity.
We're driving around on one of these little windy mountain roads, and there's a sign that says, the Museum of the Gâteau Basque. I can't even begin to tell you, just seeing the sign, how excited it made me. The idea that there could be a museum devoted just to a cake, I mean, it won my heart, of course. We followed the signs, and there was a house, and there was what I assumed was the museum. And so we walked around, we were the only people there, poked our noses around, and by the time we got back to the kiosk, the place was jammed. And as it turned out, it wasn't so much a museum as a baking demonstration. The chef, he stood at his table, and in front of him, he had what looked like an acre of dough. He said, "Now, you have to taste this dough." And he grabbed just a hunk of it and just passed it to the first person on the first pew. And that person kind of took off a chunk and passed it to the next person. And I thought, okay, we're no longer in America. Nobody said, "Oh, where are your plastic gloves? Oh, I don't want to eat the dough you're eating. Oh, there are raw eggs." People just nibbled the dough and tasted.
And it created a sense of communion in that act also.
Well,
you were all together
almost,
from that point.
It's funny because I said passed it to the first person in the pew as though we were sitting. We were, breaking bread. You're right. It did create a kind of community because we all started to talk to one another about what it tasted like. The chef had really devoted this part of his life to making gâteau basque.
It turned out the chef worked in New York with a chef Dory knew quite well. It's a small world after all.
Let's get the dough out of the fridge.
So back to work in my kitchen, two circles of dough thoroughly chilled. We wash our hands and it's time to put together our gâteau basque.
Yes, we're baking, but it's also, it's its own little arts and crafts project actually. So
Dory takes that rolled-out circle of dough and presses it into the bottom of a greased 8-inch cake pan, like she's making pie. And don't worry, complete instructions are on our website, npr.org. Next in our process comes the filling.
I've used lots of things inside of it. Whatever jam I've had in the refrigerator, it's great with blueberry. It's actually nice with cranberry relish inside of it. You know, not savory relish, but like a cranberry sauce. It's good with lemon curd. You can really play around with it. It won't be traditional, but it will be good.
You will need about 3/4 of a cup of whatever filling you choose and a little bit of water to help seal the top to the bottom of the dough. And baker's luck, there's just enough leftover dough for us to fashion a Basque cross. It looks like a flattened pinwheel on the top of the cake, a signal that this cake is full of jam. Into the oven at 350 degrees and out about 40 minutes later and then into our mouths.
Remember I said it's a dry cake? I'm always afraid to use the word dry with cake because it sounds like a fault. But in this case, it's not at all.
You have that. It's not like something that wasn't stored well.
Exactly. You have the jam filling, which is by its nature moist. And then the cake, which is a little like cookie, a little like pie, a little like cake. It's one of the most unusual desserts I know.
And I don't mean any disrespect, but if a Pop-Tart
I know exactly.
Moved up in the world and became a bit more elegant, this is what it might taste like.
It's a perfect description of it. You're right. So a grown-up Pop-Tart.
Well, when we bring you in to bake, we're hoping that this is a wonderful journey for the listener as well. And if I may say, I hope that this is one recipe that the listeners really do embrace. If you're a baker, please try this one.
Oh, I
hope so. If you're not a baker, find someone who is and have them make one of these for you.
No.
Or bake it with them. That's even better.
Bake it with them. Bake it with
them. But one way or another, get close to this because it's delicious.
Well, I'm so glad you like it. I'm so glad.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Dury Greenspan is the author of Baking From My Home to Yours.
And as Michelle promised, you can find the recipe for Gâteau Basque at our website, npr.org.
Up next, our video producer, Flora Lichtman, is here. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
Got our video pick of the week up on our website today?
Yes, we do. And it's something a little different.
Ooh.
It's a rare thing when the video pick of the week breaks news.
Ooh. Wait, let me give it the introduction you need. This just in.
And it's actually, it's news, science news about a dilemma that I think is on a lot of people's minds right now.
Which is?
Will the alcohol I add to my homemade eggnog kill any dangerous bacteria, you know, namely salmonella, because they're raw eggs and eggnog?
I remember this must be part two to the eggnog saga.
It's true. We are recycling the idea. We did do it last year. But it's good. It's like real science. We're adding to this this body of knowledge on this important holiday question.
We have been doing or getting help with Rockefeller University.
Here. Yes.
What happens if you, what's the right word, spike?
Spike. Definitely spike.
Spike your eggnog with lots of alcohol.
Right. I mean, and I think the important thing is we've gotten help because this lab has a vested interest in this question. It's Vince Fischetti and Raymond Shook, who are in the microbiologists at Rockefeller. Mm-hmm. And they have been making this eggnog with raw eggs for 40 years. It dates back to this famous scientist, Dr. Rebecca Lancefield, who worked there. And so for 40 years, they've been doing raw eggnog. And now they're investigating it.
And then raw eggs is a dangerous kind of eggnog, right? Because the salmonella could grow in it.
That is the question. Can the salmonella survive in spiked eggnog? And here's another little twist. They actually make the eggnog at Thanksgiving and let it sit in a refrigerator for 6 weeks, which sounds to me kind of disgusting.
Yeah, but there's a surprising result that happens, isn't there?
It's very surprising.
Should we give it away? Just let people know. You have to go to our website at sciencefriday.com and look at the video pick of the week.
I think this is news you can use.
This is news you can use, but we want to warn them, don't try this at home.
Yeah, big disclaimer. I mean, this is a single study, sample size of one, so take it with a grain of salt. This is not like the theory of evolution.
Right.
We are really at the forefront of this body of
and
research.
And they inject a whole lot of live salmonella into this eggnog.
Yeah, they really do a test. They make a vat of eggnog. This is the experiment. They make a vat of eggnog, and they put in salmonella, like 10 doses, as if you were making an eggnog batch with every egg had salmonella in it. And then they watch to see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And we find out.
And then they add a whole bunch of alcohol.
Yeah, that is key, I think.
Key. They add a whole bunch of liquor to us. Call it what it is. But then they sits in the refrigerator for weeks, right?
Right. It sits in the fridge for weeks.
And we find out what happens to the drinkability, shall I call it?
Yes, the drinkability.
The drinkability of the eggnog after all these weeks sitting in this brew.
Yeah, and one little thing that might pique your interest is that after they add all this alcohol, which is like a pint of rum and a quart of brandy or bourbon, it doesn't kill the salmonella right away.
No.
So.
And that's the surprising part. That if you go to our website at sciencefriday.com, you can watch them make. And Flora went to their lab again, follow up from last year, and they continue to do this and advance the science.
So yes, they're advancing the science on this.
Advancing the science. You watch Flora, we have the whole recipe go on. It goes on for quite a few minutes. It's quite interesting. It's better than a cooking show. I don't think Iron Chef is going to have these guys
watch
on.
Watch out, Elton Brown.
There you go. See if he can make it better. And and you'll watch what happens in making this eggnog and what happens after it gets laced with this alcohol.
And one more disclaimer. If you really want to be safe, you know, there's always So show us the stuff off the shelves.
Right. Stick with that.
Stick with that.
All right, Flora, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ira.
Quite interesting. That's about all the time we have for today. Check that out on our website at sciencefriday.com, a pick of the week, along with dozens of others there. Our program is produced by Christopher Taliata, senior producer Ned Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora is our producer for digital media. Laura Pelcher, our SciArts producer. And Shelley DuBois, I love to get her name wrong, Shelley DuBois is our Spanish language producer. Neil Rausch, our technical director, and he's at the controls here in New York. And we had help in Second Life from Lynn Collins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. You can send your email to us. It's best to surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we're podcasting and tweeting and twittering and all that kinds of stuff, at SciFry all week. And you can also send us your email over there if you'd like. I'm Ira Flatto in New York.
With the holidays fast approaching, it's time to put the finishing touches on Yuletide decorations and last-minute prep for those year-end parties. And it's been a very busy time for style maven Martha Stewart.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to our show. Last week, we had the honor of decorating several rooms in Blair House in Washington, D.C.
On our show this past week, Martha Stewart showed off her team's work decorating several rooms of Blair House. It's the presidential guest residence across from the White House. She was one of a handful of magazine publishers invited to spruce up the historic home. Martha Stewart joins us from her radio studio in New York. Welcome to the program.
Oh, it's very nice to talk to you today. Thank you.
How did it go at Blair House?
You know, it was really nice. And my crew, who I sent down from television and from the magazine, six of them, were ecstatic to be able to work in an American home. The Lee dining room was Lee drawing room, excuse me, is papered in an 18th century Chinese wallpaper. We photographed the wallpaper and we took various elements from the wallpaper, like all the painted birds, and we silhouetted them and made them glitter with our numerous shades of glitter. And we hung them on a giant tree. We stood them on tables around the room. And they were really the focal point of the decoration.
But, you know, most of us have pretty modest homes. And, you know, we're in this final stretch leading up to Christmas and New Year's. Any ideas how we could maybe quickly and easily do something to make our house festive?
Well, if you're celebrating Christmas, a tree, I think, is essential. And the trees this year, many people have opted for the artificial tree. You can use them year after year. You can fold them up and put them in the attic. And many of them are tabletop trees, which I think are wonderful for a small apartment. You just put them on the table and decorate them with a collection of whatever. You can do birds or ornaments that you've collected over the years. I still have a lot of my family ornaments from when I grew up on 86 Elm Place in Nutley, New Jersey. And this year, I think everybody's a little cash strapped also.
Yeah.
It is not a year to hang diamonds in your Christmas tree. This is the year of the do-it-yourself, the handmade, the homemade. Mm-hmm. I think making things has given so many people a great deal of pleasure. And if you do make things, if you do involve the rest of the family in these projects, I think you'll enjoy it better and you will be proud of what you've done. And there is sort of a sense of accomplishment, too.
You know, a lot of people get stressed out because they have in-laws coming, relatives coming, you know, a house full. Have any idea how to kind of prepare for that?
Well, I think everybody gets stressed out around these holidays. It's amazing to me. I was starting to get stressed out until this morning, and then when I finished all my lists and figured, well, you know what, the Christmas cards are gone, the presents are wrapped, I should relax a little bit and enjoy. And indeed, that's what I'm trying to do. But a lot of people look a little harried around my office. We have a lot of people here who are very diligent, and they want to do a good thing. But they are sharing. A lot of people are sharing duties this year. I think that's another good thing to try to organize. If you're having five couples over, ask each couple to bring something, their specialty. And that they like to participate, and they feel good about it. And it makes it makes everything a little bit warmer and cozier.
I'm speaking with Martha Stewart about entertaining tips for the holiday. You mentioned, going back to your childhood, having childhood ornaments from your childhood, because this is really a holiday that has a lot of sentiment to it. Do you have a picture of a fond memory of holidays past that may have shaped your vision?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Every year we took the picture of the tree. And the one year that my parents allowed me to take over the decorating, I must say it was the most unfortunate looking tree. I was playing around. I was asked to be the decorating chairman of the high school prom. And I got it in my mind that I had to use blue angel hair. You know, this is like spun glass. Do you remember that old stuff?
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I think is probably so environmentally unsound, but I bought rolls and rolls of it. So I thought, wow, you know what? I'll try it on the tree. I swathed the tree in blue angel hair, pale blue. It looked horrible. It just looked like a blue cone sitting in our living room. And we all posed in front of it. I have the picture of me in my blue velvet dress and the whole family, my five siblings and my mom and dad. And we were all kind of laughing because it was so horrible.
Oh, and your hands must have been, I mean, that stuff.
Oh, we
hurt.
Wore gloves.
Oh,
we wore gloves.
Good.
It's like bad insulation, that's this stuff.
But I'm looking at the cover of the January issue of Martha Stewart Living, and it says,
Do you like that soup?
It looks very good, but it happy New Year, eat better, live better, feel good. Just, I think, what we all want. So what advice do you have for staying healthy?
January is our body action plan. This is our whole living month where we take into consideration not only your mind and the beauty that your mind desires, but also your body. We have overeaten. We have sugar. We have eaten so much sugar. And it's time to really do not only – you don't have to do a major cleanse or a detox, but you can really pay attention to what you consume, not just in the month of January, but for the whole year. I am a very avid believer in buying and eating organic, if I can possibly. I grow a lot of stuff. I am very serious about the kinds of foods that I partake of. And in the January issue, we have how to shop for fruits and vegetables and weigh your choices in the produce aisle. So we have the clean 15 and we have the dirty dozen. Avocados, corn, pineapples, mangoes, asparagus, kiwi fruits, cabbages, eggplants. Those are probably some of the best things that you can actually put in your body. And then if you want to know, do you want to know the dirty dozen?
Yeah, what's the dirty dozen?
Well, these are fruits and vegetables that you want to eat. We all crave, like carrots, celery, lettuce, cherries, strawberries, pears, apples, grapes. But if they are not produced organically, they absorb a tremendous amount of not only the pesticides that they're grown with, sprayed with, but also the chemical fertilizers that are in the ground when they grow in. So you have to pay attention to this because I think to really, really treat your body well and your family's bodies well, you have to start thinking a little bit more in the organic vein.
Martha Stewart joined us from her radio studio in New York. Thank you. Happy holidays and a happy new year.
And same to you.
This is NPR's Weekend Edition. I'm Leanne Hansen. Happy holidays, everyone.